In this last week, I've been doing readings about samadhi mostly, and then there's aspects of samadhi as concentration, and then concentration and discernment, and you know, there was a lot of heady stuff in there, and a lot of very, very practical stuff, but also there's quite a lot of refined things in that. And one of the things that came up in my mind was in terms of the kind of foundation or the basis for these many of these say refined states or states of calm, states of tranquility, states of composure. And I thought I'd talk about that tonight, just some of the conditions and supports that the Buddha outlined for the development of concentration and discernment, for the path actually. And it comes up in quite a few discourses. But the one that I was reminded of was the discourse to Ganaka Moggallana, which is the sort of Moggallana, the accountant. And Moggallana goes to the Buddha and asks the Buddha if there is a progressive path or a progressive training. Is in that, is it that the, there is a, in the world one can see evidence or examples of progressive paths of different things, and even the building that you're in. Can't remember. I think he was in something like the palace of Nigara's mother in the eastern park or something like that. And in that, you know, in order to build a building, you've got to start from the foundations and build it up, and or each staircase is going to work from the bottom and go up. I said, and even examples of establishing a livelihood. The Brahmins have a progressive training and progressive learning. Even his sort of guild of accountants, they have to learn. Start from the basics and work up and get some skill. And the Buddha says, yes, there is a progressive path of training. And that the Buddha trains his students in, his disciples in. And he goes through that path, explains it in detail, and then Moggallana, the accountant, sort of asks the question, sort of, well, if you've got this progressive path and you've got this progressive training, clear training, that's supposed to lead to Nibbana, does everybody reach nirvana? And the Buddha says, no. He says, wow, what, you know, why is that? What's sort of in the sense of, either in terms of doubt or in the sense of, well, it must be a defective path or something, you think. Not everybody reaches it. And then the Buddha gives this famous simile of asking Moggallana, the accountant, well, do you know the path to Rajagaha? You know the road to Rajagaha? He says, yeah, of course I know it. He says, and you know, could you explain it to somebody else? And he says, yes. And he says, well, and is that, but do you think everybody who took your directions would reach Rajagaha? Because there'd invariably be those who took a wrong turn here, a wrong turn there. And he said, well, yeah, actually, that's very much the case. But that's not my fault. I only give the directions. And the Buddha says, well, it's the same for me. Nibbana exists, the path to Nibbana exists, and all I do is point out the path. So that it's, I think it's important, reflecting on that, when we consider the training and the parts of the training, parts of the path, so that we're recognizing what the training is for. Because it's so often that we get stuck into one particular aspect of the training and forget where it's supposed to be going to, forget where it's supposed to be heading, and then inevitably don't say reach the goal. So that keeping that goal in mind when we think of each aspect of the training, that it's clearly for reaching Nibbana, reaching the end of suffering, reaching a place of freedom, a place of a relinquishment of the defilements and attachments within the heart. And each part of the path is for that. So the path of training that the Buddha lays out begins with the keeping of precepts. And in the discourse he uses the example of the monks, and that he encourages them to keep the Patimokkha training and keeping the Patimokkha training is a sort of one aspect of precepts, or one set of precepts, and there's within that there's the Bhikkhuni Patimokkha, the Bhikkhu Patimokkha trainings, and then the training for novices, lay people, Uposatha Sila, and all of that is these different aspects of precepts you know, one starts to look at it, and it they all have fundamental goals. One is, and the first is to sort of restraining those things which are harmful to oneself and harmful to others, and creating sort of problems and difficulties, suffering for oneself and for others. And then the other is a further training in just refinement of awareness, refinement of conduct. And an ability to, say, take on a training that, a training in precepts that allows one to turn one's attention to, what kind of intentions, mental states form our actions in body and speech. So that, whatever level of precepts one is taking, that is what we're using it for, because that's what will be useful for leading us to nibbana, to liberation. If we just take precepts for, and it doesn't matter whatever number or level of precepts, if we take them and cling to them, thinking that we're somehow they're going to purify us, if only we can say keep more of them, keep them as totally strictly as possible, making sure the letter of each rule is being kept. That is whole, usually what it's being held by is, say, held out of fear or held out of view and a particular view and opinion. And of course that's not going to purify, it's not going to make the heart peaceful either. So that they, and it's striking then when the Buddha talks about the characteristics of a stream enterer, and keeping the precepts, and that or talking about precepts, they say the precepts that are sort of dear to the noble ones, and that are conducive to concentration, leading to concentration, so that the precepts are part of the laying the foundation, this first step of this gradual training, progressive training. And in the actual discourse, the Buddha encourages that the precepts are to be kept in a diligent, assiduous way. But and that's definitely that's the heart of it. And we can think of Ajahn Chah was a teacher who really was very precepts were really important to him. And he was very careful in maintaining precepts, and then also teaching people to be keeping the precepts and keeping all the forms of training as well, that they that the precepts, because what they're cultivating a certain quality of respect and faith in the whole path of training. I mean, it's like holding precepts is a it's like an external way that we can both express our express our gratitude, or express our faith, our confidence in the Buddha's teachings, and so I mean it works both ways in the sense of you know, one is keeping the precepts for the benefit that comes for oneself and for the society around keeping, but it's also it has a certain, it's not just for the precepts themselves, there's many ramifications of the precepts, and what and some of it is, you know, can be really minor precepts. It's like Ajahn Chah would sort of say that, remember him saying that the it isn't the breaking of the major precepts that will obstruct your enlightenment. It's the breaking of the minor ones, sort of that. Because you know, often you can sort of see the logic of the not killing and not stealing. Those are quite obvious. But you know, when there's more more minor precepts, more sort of in training, and something that goes against the one's idea of what's convenient, what's not convenient, what is popular, or what might be perceived as not really up with the times. And this is even in the time of the Buddha. And that kind of fudging of precepts, picking and choosing of precepts, and different forms of training that are within the precepts. Those are the kind of things that the mind is sort of bargaining and using its defilements and its attachments as a standards, rather than just giving oneself to training. Think of the time that when Ajahn Chah was invited to go he was invited by the king and the royal family to go to a dana, a meal at the palace, and he was staying at a city monastery prior to going to the invitation, and as he was preparing to leave to go to the invitation, he's getting his alms bowl ready, and one of the senior monks who was at the monastery, who was a scholar and had a degree, a position, a maha degree and a jalkun position, title, and seeing Ajahn Chah preparing his alms bowl, and he's looking at it as, you know, caught this country bumpkin from the forest, from Ubon in particular, northeasterner. He's really from another century. And ask Ajahn Chah, aren't you embarrassed taking your alms bowl to this invitation for the king? Aren't you embarrassed what the king will think? And Ajahn Chah for the book and said, aren't you embarrassed not taking your alms bowl? What would the Buddha think? It was a different standard. And that was Ajahn Chah. This is how the Buddha trained, and that's how I'm going to be doing it. And it was clear to him. That was just, so it's an element of precepts, an element of a training. And there's many, many, both written and unwritten, whether it's for the monastics or for the lay community, there's certain sort of standards and certain ways of training that are appropriate, and it's really just there, and they are a training, and to take them on as a training, so that there's a a certain quality of relinquishment that is already embedded in that, a certain quality of relying on Buddha Dhamma Sangha rather than relying on one's own particular view, opinion, preference, idea, ideal. So I'd say, sort of seeing how they're already there, you're sort of looking at, how does it tie into the goal? So that if one is getting off on starting this progressive training, now we're starting off on the right foot. The next aspect of the progressive training that the Buddha pointed to was the aspect of central strength and the maintaining of restraint of the senses, eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, the mind itself. Recognizing that when it's not sort of looked after, when when one isn't attentive, when one isn't showing restraint, that the mind goes to those things which bring up the word is. The words that are used, covetousness and grief, is the way it's usually translated. Ambichanto manasa. And the desire or painful circumstance, whether it's aversion or ill will or some other kind of state of mind that brings sadness to the mind, the quality of, say, the opposite of delight, Somanasa is delight and happiness. Domanasa is its opposite, sort of grief and trouble. So that when one recognizes that when the faculty of eye, ears, nose, tongue, body, mind aren't watched over, aren't restrained, aren't careful with, then it leads to some kind of agitation and unskillful mental states arising. And just to exercise that quality of restraint, not looking at as I was saying, not taking that not following the impulse to look or hear, listen to, or to speak, or to get engaged in the external world. That is, say, we still don't have the wisdom and understanding that cuts off and undermines the tendencies of the tendencies towards desire and trouble. So, on a certain level, it says one is just having the humility to begin with, that we that we actually do need to restrain the senses from time to time. And it's so easy to rationalize and justify the something that is that we want to be engaged in externally, or to sort of have the justification of it being learning from the senses, being open to all the sensory stimulus. One doesn't want to restrict anything, because one should be learning from everything. And it's got a certain logic to it, but if the result is abhijja and tomanasa, covetousness and grief arising in the mind, then it would have probably been much wiser to have some restraint, being able to sort of put up some barriers, or like just having road bumps to slow the mind down, slow the habit patterns down. The next aspect of this progressive training that the Buddha outlines is moderation in eating. And I know that's a fairly basic thing that we do, eating every day. But no, I'd say one can see what it does to the mind when if there isn't a sense of establishing mindfulness, or even if there is establishing mindfulness, one starts with good intentions at the beginning of the table, and it crumples very quickly. Just being able to hold that that intention of working with moderation in eating. The recitation that we do it sort of gets the wisely reflecting and resolves food. Is sort of places the basic theme, and to it's like replacing replacing the one the dukkha of hunger with the the well-being of living mindfully and at ease. When we're and particularly in terms of practice and the cultivation of samadhi, if you're having difficulties with dullness, sleepiness, or even extreme states of mind, one of the first advice that will be given is just decrease your amount of eating. Are you eating too much? Because it has an effect. Everything has its effect. Or what is one eating? Being attentive to the things that one eats, that they're actually, one is it's balanced in terms of balance in terms of nutrition, balanced in terms of the kind of foods that are appropriate for giving oneself energy, but also over long term. And that affects one's practice, affects one's concentration. Starting to be attentive to it, because the nature of the mind, when it's especially in say eating one meal a day, and being restrained in so many other ways, the mind is looking for stimulation, looking for any kind of excitement. So the meal is pretty exciting, and then if one gets swept up into that and get caught up in that, then it leaves the mind frazzled at the end of the meal, or excited, or dull and depressed because one is sort of overeaten, or one is not sort of followed a standard that one knows is skillful. And there's a certain remorse there. So the mind is dull. So when one's able to use that moderation in eating, then the mind is quite buoyant after the meal and after. And if one hasn't sort of got all caught up into excitement of the meal, then there's a continuity of composure that allows one to finish the meal, wash up, clean up, put your stuff together, get back to one's dwelling place, and then continue practicing. Whereas if without moderation in eating, then they're sort of getting swept up into agitation, excitement. Well, then that carries on. One usually ends up in conversation or get looking for some other distraction after. And then it's just not conducive for concentration. It's not conducive for the continuity of meditation. So that it's laying the, all of these things are laying the foundation for the meditation. And what the meditation is for in terms of for nibbana, for freedom from suffering. The next thing that the Buddha says in terms of training and a progressive training is devotion to wakefulness. Keeping of, he said, as when, say, during the day, doing walking and sitting. During walking and sitting, then say purifying the mind of its dullness or reticence to for practice bringing up those states of mind that are conducive to wakefulness, brightness, alertness. And then the Buddha says, and also in the, say like in the first watch of the night, and similarly, keeping the alternating of walking meditation, sitting meditation. Then the middle watch of the night, lying down mindfully, resting, and then the third watch of the night, getting up, and then continuing the practice of keeping alertness, wakefulness, mindfulness to the walking and sitting practice. So cultivating that continuity of training and keeping a wakefulness, alertness, a sense of staying with the meditation and reflection on Dhamma. And again, it's sort of important to say, well, what is, so again, not just sort of bashing away at a meditation object, but also say, well, what's the meditation for? Walking meditation, sitting meditation, what's it for? What am I supposed to be accomplishing with this? What am I, how is it supposed to be fruitful, beneficial? And then maintaining that reflection and with a sense of wakefulness, alertness, keeping the perspective clear. Now that when setting one's sights on Nibbana as a purpose, and you know, it's important not to make something like Nibbana so abstract that it doesn't. It's not workable. It's not something that you're able to use in your daily practice. I mean, there's so many it has tended to become abstracted and so refined and distant in Buddhist tradition, but you know, the way the Buddha talked about it, literally it means cooling. Well, there's all sorts of translations. Sometimes justice is unbinding. And that's a really useful image. Okay, how do I use, whether it's the precepts or sense restraint or moderation in eating, devotion to wakefulness, how do I use that for unbinding, untying the knots, loosening the things that bind me to suffering, bind me to confusion, bind me to the qualities of unskillfulness, sort of that which keeps me in bondage. How do I unbind that? Remember one of the images of Ajahn Chah that I really like was saying, you know, so often in practice, you know, we're unaware of the how we keep practicing and keep sort of turning up intensity in practice, but what we're oftentimes doing is like tightening a nut on a screw, tightening and tightening and tightening, and really what we should be doing is loosening it and unwinding the screw, not taking it, winding it back that way. So it's like for unbinding rather than for more binding, because the screw just keeps, the nut just keeps getting tighter and tighter. But what we really want to be doing is undoing this, and not going the opposite direction. So that to investigate and be attentive to the effort we put in. So all of these practices are for unbinding, or for say nibbana, or for cooling. Another translation for nibbana is cooling, you know, cooling of the fires of Ajahn Buddhadasa. Uses that it would, you know, always sort of would explain that the nibbana was a verb that was used for just in ordinary day-to-day language. I would say that you take the rice pot off the fire and the same thing, you set it out to cool, and set it to, and the rice would nibbana. Well, that's pretty ordinary. But you know, so that sense of cooling, you know, letting the fires of greed, hatred, and delusion actually cool down. To be attentive to that, you know, are they, you know, the practices that we're doing, even if they're, you know, right from the very beginning, the very basics, you know, are they for cooling of greed, hatred, and delusion, the cooling of the passions of, that are holding us to the world. So that that quality of having a view as to where the goal is, so that all of the practices are supporting them. And the next sort of step on the progressive training that the Buddha laid out was being possessed of mindfulness and full awareness. And so that in one's walking, sitting, standing, lying down, engaging in conversation, doing particular tasks, chores, as we say, reaching out, moving forward, moving backward, even to the going to the toilet. All of it is this is the ground, the basis for cultivation of mindfulness and full awareness. And that there's so often the sense that we never have enough time to practice. And if it's the same, and the feeling is oftentimes even in retreat, like 24 hours a day isn't quite enough to be able to do all the practice that we think we need, and oftentimes it's quite true, but that sense of but it's usually because we're viewing everything from a sense of an idea of how we should be practicing, and it's always the goal is externalized. But that bringing mindfulness into mindfulness and full awareness into everything that we're doing makes the practice really a timeless one. A kali toll, not bound with time. And it's extremely important that our practice is brought into the present moment, into what we're doing. One in the sense of because that the tendency to externalize isn't just in our activity, it's even when we have the opportunity to sit meditation, we're still externalizing, looking for that practice is going to be when I get job or when I get some kind of continuity of mindfulness of breathing together, or when I get the 16 steps of Anapanasati together, then it's always oriented outside. And so that bringing it back into the present, what one is doing is what the practice is. So that is, and then also for that continuity of practice in terms of our concentration practice, meditation practice, wisdom practices. If we're not cultivating a continuity and establishing that strong foundation in mindfulness, moment to moment mindfulness, present moment mindfulness, then it's very difficult to have the momentum within the heart that when we actually sit down to meditate or get on our walking meditation path, that where the mind stays there, because we've managed to accumulate enough distraction and agitation that we carry that around with us. It's sort of like the Peanuts comic strip. pig pen and goes around with this, the dust and things. In this cloud all the time. And that's sort of what we're, you know, we tend to, not keeping that continuity of mindfulness and full awareness, then we carry this cloud around with us. That's why I remember one monk who was at Wat Nanachat, and he'd as a layperson, he'd done a tremendous amount of drugs and was also a dealer, and he was, you know, he's a lot. He came and practiced and ordained, and but there was, for the first several years, it was just like this haze of drugs and confusion, you know, who came and followed him around. And to a, you know, to a lesser degree, that's, you know, very much what we carry around as well. So that cultivation and focus on mindfulness and full awareness it really cuts through and is necessary to cut through a lot of the habits and just the lack of clarity and precision that is necessary for both for concentration as well as for investigation, discernment. Without a clarity and precision in sustaining attention, then it's very difficult to settle the mind. And it's really incumbent on us to really take that. So the opportunity is walking back and forth to our dwelling place, being down here. We've got various, even a retreat. You know, when we're on retreat, we've still got chores that we need to be doing. But it's important that our attention is directed toward that. Being attentive to what we're doing. So it's being done in mindfulness and full awareness. And one of the ways of being able to hold that or sustain that is really getting grounded in that. Awareness of the body, and being grounded in how one is feeling and perceiving movement, activity, feelings in the body. It's interesting in that Kipagiri Sutta that I read yesterday, the day before, yesterday I guess. Talking about the different levels of attainment, the certain different alternative structure of the realizations, and how much there was reference to the body all through that, whether it was the liberation of an arahant, or one liberated by wisdom. There's reference to the body all through that. So that making the body a focal point for sustaining this mindfulness and full awareness. Then the, in terms of the progressive training that, that the Buddha lays out, then it's, then he goes into the, you know, going to the foot of a tree, sitting cross-legged, holding mindfulness in front, and then dealing with the five hindrances, and then the cultivation of the jhanas. So that the you know, just drawing attention to the qualities that that nourish or lay the foundations for the those states of concentration and qualities of meditation. Because so often we're all interested in meditation, and you know, we all want to really cultivate and achieve some fruits from it. But I think it's easy to just sort of go to the meditation and forget the things which are going to really nurture and support, so that those qualities of precepts of sense restraint, of moderation in eating, devotion to wakefulness, mindfulness, full awareness. Those are essential aspects of training. But then, as also as I was saying, just being very clear of what it's for. You know, all of those levels, all of those parts of the progressive training are focused towards towards Nibbana, towards that is the purpose, their function, and not getting the, let me say again, not making the goal or the too abstract. I'm keeping it focused of what, you know, how do I use these different practices? And that the Buddha in one of the discourses, you know, was asked quite, what's the short way of being able to realize the fruits of this practice, and how do you put it all into some short, succinct way of looking at it? And the Buddha, this is where that phrase of sambhay dhammanala apinivai sign, to see that all dhammas are not to be clung to, or not to be adhered to, not holding. Nothing is worth holding on to, nothing is worth clinging to. Seeing that as long as we're clinging and holding with adhering to something that is through desire, through fear, through aversion to some kind of misapprehension of reality, of truth, and it'll bring suffering. And that's exactly what the path is for overcoming, for freeing ourselves from. So that too, sort of lining up these, there are these progressive trainings, but it's for a purpose. There's a progressive training, but within each aspect of it, there's the lesson to be learned that encapsulates or is the sort of the essence of the whole path. So that getting a feel for how to put the effort and attention and patience into cultivating this progressive training, but fulfilling sort of the heart of it and the purpose of it in each, say in each moment or in part of the path, and this is where they come together, because if one is rigidly sort of fixed on a progressive model of training, then it usually goes on and on forever. There's no end to it. But if one isn't sort of willing to put the effort and the time into that progressive training, just sort of holding an ideal of, oh, I'm going to be liberated, or it's not necessary, then say the practice is one doesn't really hit the mark either. I'll offer these reflections this evening.